If you're a fan of Twin Peaks, you've got to read The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer by Jennifer Lynch. Today's episode of our Grey Lodge series will be going through some elements of this book that pertain to a larger theory about what is going on in the Twin Peaks universe. We'll be discussing Jennifer's occult method of automatic writing to pull in from the same creative force as her father as we get to the backstory of Laura Palmer's tragic life. We'll talk about supernatural entities, Bob, the owls, Laura's drugs and sex, doppelgangers, sexual abuse, and many other dangerous topics. Listen close and you'll hear about some connections to topics like creamed corn, the convenience store, a possible meaning for the white horse, an occult ritual orgy in the woods, and so much more. My name is Isaac Weishaupt, and you're in the Grey Lodge. Hope you like my dramatic intros, folks. Yeah, you're listening to the Grey Lodge. This is the Twin Peaks bonus deep dives that we do. And this is one of the most important parts of the Twin Peaks universe, I think. This is one of the things that hooked me in, because as you know, my first journey through Twin Peaks had a lot of highs and lows, a lot of times where I felt engaged, and other times where I thought, I'm bailing on this, I don't want to do this, this is stupid. And the book, The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer, it's iconic to say the least. And you know, I like Twin Peaks itself, I don't know why it speaks to me the way it does. I kind of feel like I went through a similar journey as Laura Palmer in a way. And she was hitting her adolescence the same time I was. So that late 80s, early 90s time frame kind of matches up. But, and I own this book in every single format. Paperback, which I delicately open the pages. This is actually a pretty mint copy of the original press of it. I got the paperback, I got a PDF, I bought the Kindle, and I bought the Audible, which is narrated by the great Cheryl Lee, who plays Laura Palmer. So, I mean, get all of them if you're a real fan, I guess. If you're a real loser like me. Now, if you're listening to this episode out of the order, I'm going to tell you, we're going to be talking about season 1 and 2, but I'm not going to talk about Fire Walk With Me or season 3, since we haven't covered those yet in the Grey Lodge series, okay? Because my next effort is going to be to cover Fire Walk With Me, the film, the prequel film. So if you look at it from a timeline perspective, the earliest piece of Twin Peaks information or storyline or dogma, whatever you want to call it, canon, official canon, is this book. Because this goes all the way back to 1984. Now, the years are a little off. They're 1 year off. Kind of a whole thing. But anyway, this is Laura Palmer from the age of 12. And then the next piece on the timeline is Fire Walk With Me, which is the prequel to season 1. That's the 1 week leading up to Laura's death. And then you got season 1, and then you got season 2. And then we wait 25 years for Secret History of Twin Peaks book. And then we got season 3, and then the final dossier. So, to recap, if you haven't listened to my season 1, season 2, or haven't watched season 1, season 2, I'm going to spoil all of it. Well, I don't know how much, but there's going to be spoilers. I'm not holding back on that. If you haven't seen Fire Walk With Me or season 3, it's fine. I'm not going to spoil anything. I will make a couple references that I'll pull out that I'll say, hey, pay attention to this because it's going to come up later. All right? Okay. Now, I'm not entirely sure how one could cover this whole book in one episode, so clearly I'm not going to cover the entire, word for word, blow by blow, but I'm going to cover the whole book, like major themes that I'm going to pull out of it. So I'm going to go over the making of the book, the background of it, and then I'll pull some interesting highlights from the book, but of course this is in no way going to cover the entire book. Hopefully it inspires you to read the whole thing. And if not, that's fine too. I will continue to be your guide here in the Grey Lodge. It's a pretty short read, not intimidating, but it's very good to understand what's going on with Laura Palmer and how she got into this situation. And it's actually much more than you get out of Fire Walk With Me, because it's from age 12 to 17, and her death is this diary. From innocence to the spiraling chaos of her death. And in some ways, this is a bit of a religious document for Twin Peaks nerds. the religion of Twin Peaks, as it were, because it documents the existence and the connection of the supernatural demonic entity of Bob to Laura Palmer. Let's start out by looking at Jennifer Lynch, the author of the book. She's, of course, David Lynch's daughter. She is also from Philly. Shout out to Philly. She was at the Wawa getting a hoagie. And, you know, David Lynch lived there for many years, but he wasn't born there. He was born in, I believe, Missoula, Montana. And he moved there to go to college to Philly. So he lived there a fair amount of time. It's where he filmed Eraserhead, I think. Well, Jennifer, like her father, has also been doing transcendental meditation for many years. It says on her Wikipedia since she was 6 years old, which is pretty wild. No wonder she was able to make contact with the creative forces on the other side. It also says she's on the board of advisors for the Hollywood Horror Museum, which I'm very excited about. I actually follow them, and I can't wait for them to finally open up here whenever that happens. She appeared in Eraserhead, but didn't make the final cut of the movie. Ain't that about a B? Well, we're going to be swearing later. I guess I can swear now. She's done many things besides write this book. She also, after this book, what year did this book come out? I think I got the first pressing here, so let me look. Let me carefully look. 1990. Because I think this book actually released between season one and season two, technically, which is kind of wild because I think that gives away the killer from season two. I don't know. Kind of. Not really. No, I guess it doesn't. Anyway, she directed a film called Boxing Helena in 1993. That was her directorial debut. It was, as Wikipedia says, a critical and commercial failure, receiving a Golden Raspberry Award for Worst Director. And then she took a 15-year hiatus. Now, I strongly, strongly disagree with that. It was a great movie. It was an outstanding movie. Now, I might be partial because Sherilyn Fenn is in it, and it's David Lynch's daughter, and all those things. But nonetheless, I mean, and that's the thing with Twin Peaks, right? Some of this stuff, it's too good for the masses. They can't handle it. It's not for them. That doesn't make it bad. On Wikipedia, it says that she directed Boxing Helena when she was 19 years old. And I dug into that. She wrote it at age 19. And the film was released at age 25. So I'm guessing it took those 6 years to release it. It says she had three spinal surgeries during this time period because of a car accident. Now, originally, Helena, who's played by Sherilyn Fenn, a.k.a. Audrey Horn, was originally supposed to be Madonna, and Ed Harris was in it, but left because of delays in filming. Kim Basinger was then supposed to be the main female protagonist, but then she quit because apparently she wanted a bunch of major script revisions, and I think she got a lawsuit involved. And actually, I was watching on Vice, they have a show about the making of the Batman films. And, I mean, it paints her in a bad light on that. It says she was always running late, insisted on using her own wardrobe, and all kinds of stuff. Now, for Boxing Helena, there was an outcry from the feminist over this movie. And I'm not going to... Let's see if I spoil it. Will I spoil Boxing Helena? I'm not going to. I'm going to read this carefully. The idea that the film was faulted when everyone involved working so fucking hard and believed in me, and there were these adults believing in me, who was essentially a child, when the National Organization of Women slammed me, that was sort of the final straw. It was no wonder I put my legs behind my ears and got pregnant. Not that I didn't love sex before then, but seriously, it was my child, essentially, who saved my life. So she, Jennifer Lynch, really went through it over this film, which is a real bummer because it's a great movie. I mean, it stars Bill Paxton, Art Garfunkel, yes, that Garfunkel. And one of the things I found interesting was the connections and symbolism, because one of the things that you'll find in Boxing Helena is the statue of the Venus de Milo. And when I watched that, I said, oh, that's from the Red Room from Twin Peaks. Now, Jennifer Lynch says that her grandmother had a replica of the Venus de Milo, which makes me wonder if that's where David Lynch found the inspiration to put it into Twin Peaks. She said, it always struck me the way people looked at the Venus. They didn't see her as broken. They saw her as beautiful. And it really made a huge impact on me. I thought I was broken and that maybe someday someone would find me beautiful. So this idea of a damaged boy who was in an obsessive situation, who would try to recreate from his own view, the one thing that didn't hit him or abandon him was this armless, beautiful woman. And therefore, in a dream, recreate this obsessive thing where we take from one another until we are the size and shape that we think the other person should be for us. So it's about accepting, right? It's about finding beauty in all things. So to come back to the book, The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer, she wrote it at the age of 22, which is kind of at the beginning of her directing the movie, Boxing Helena. And when she wrote it, she was told to pretend she was Laura Palmer. And she said that she knew Laura so well that it was like automatic writing. Now, automatic writing is an occult practice. This goes back to John Dee and Edward Kelly because they channeled the language from the Enochian language from the entities, the aliens, the angels, whatever you want to call it. Crowley did automatic writing for the Book of the Law when AWOS spoke through Rose Kelly and all this other stuff. William Burroughs also, he claimed that he wrote Naked Lunch. He called it an automatic writing gone horribly wrong because the subconscious was taken over by a hostile entity. If you read from knowledgelost.org, it says, in 1959, he released Naked Lunch, which he described as automatic writing gone horribly wrong. The author here wrote, previously I've posted about automatism, but it is a process of writing where the writer tries to avoid conscious thoughts. Burroughs has said that Naked Lunch wasn't a book he wanted to write, but he had no choice but write it. He couldn't write anything else. When it came to using André Breton's method of automism, where the subconscious focuses on one image or phase, Burroughs found his subconscious was taken over by a hostile entity. The results speak for itself. Naked Lunch is not only full of obscene language, but completely weird. Then we found out, if you keep reading, Burroughs would collaborate with a guy named Brian Geisen, an artist, to do this surrealist cut-up method, where artists would take an existing text, cut it up to create a new one, which he did with Naked Lunch to create some other books later on. Geisen, he's a famous artist who did a lot of, he was influential in the beat movement, the counterculture, with figures like Genesis P. Ulrich and our beloved David Bowie, a.k.a. Philip Jeffries. That's right. Some say that a spirit influences the writing in automatic writing, but others say it actually comes from the subconscious. So in this instance, I lean towards the subconscious idea, since David Lynch is so good at making contact with the subconscious, and Twin Peaks is basically a case study in how to do that. Now, side note, John Dee, who did automatic writing as well, he did it and was able to find the location for the Elixir of Life. I'm going to read you from encyclopedia.com. Dee and Kelly acquired a considerable reputation for the occult, which spread from Mortlake to continental Europe. Dee declared that he possessed the Elixir of Life, which he claimed to have found among the ruins of Glastonbury Abbey, so the curious were drawn to his house by a double attraction. Gold flowed into his coffers, but his experiments in the transmutations of metals absorbed a great portion of the money. Now, let's go back to the season 2 finale. Remember, we talked about Glastonbury Grove and the legend of King Arthur. Here we have yet another strange connection. Now, this book, Secret Diary of Laura Palmer, some bookstores wouldn't stock it due to the content being too graphic. That's bookstores. Now, I don't know how that fares with the current banning of books all over libraries and high schools. It is pretty graphic. I'll give you that. I don't know what age would be appropriate for a child to read it, if at all. It depends on, you know, I was exposed to a lot as a kid and I'm fine, but it is heavy content. It's, you know, drugs and sex. It's very descriptive. It's definitely pretty hardcore. Now, the audiobook for it on Audible, narrated by Cheryl Lee, was released in 2017, around the same time as season 3. Also, when there's a timeline issue here, because the book actually assumes that the series takes place in 1990, but we know from the show it's 1989. So the diary, there's some diary entries after Laura's already dead, which is strange. But I think it's just a fluke, I guess. I don't know. There's an interview with Vice magazine and Jennifer Lynch. She said, this was interesting, talking about being raised by David Lynch. She said, "I was only spanked once, and he says he regretted it. Apparently, I didn't deserve it. The only time I distinctly remember being yelled at was when I was about 7 or 8. He found me reading Helter Skelter, and he squatted down in front of me, and I remember the sunlight surrounding his head, and he said, 'There is darkness, and then there is light, and then there is evil.' And he grabbed the book out of my hands and pitched it across the yard and said, 'This is evil.' I was obsessed with Vincent Bugliosi. I thought he was a great attorney. I was fascinated with the book." Now, I'd love to speak to Jennifer Lynch about the Bugliosi obsession, because I myself am very intrigued by the Charles Manson case, especially since the Tom O'Neill Chaos book came out and basically, you know, poked a big old hole in Vincent Bugliosi's case. And I found interesting that David Lynch was referring to some Gnostic schools of thought here. He said, "There's darkness and then there is light." You know, and that's the Gnostic duality idea of dark and light, good and evil. But some occultists think we need to explore both good and evil. And I'm hoping that this is David's way of saying don't explore the evil, because he says there's darkness and there's light and then there is evil. And he throws the book. Which is actually very strange, because Helter Skelter is a fascinating read. I've read that book too. It's just a very factual sort of rundown of how Bugliosi thinks the case went, the whole Manson story. They asked Jennifer Lynch about Kim Basinger, who was supposed to be in Boxing Helena. And she said, "Well, I have no ill feelings towards Kim at all, and I didn't even back then. I feel sad that she took the advice of a brand new agent who came on after we made our deal. This was the man who refused to shake my hand and instead patted me on the head and said to my face, 'She's not going to do your movie, little camper.'" Wow, that's condescending. They ask her about the secret diary. And Jennifer says that when she was 12 years old, she told her dad that she wished she could find another girl's diary to read and see if they were sharing the same feelings. Now, was this some kind of subconscious pull towards writing the secret diary of Laura Palmer? I don't know. And in the secret diary, there's a dream Laura has that we'll talk about. Laura Palmer has a dream about a rat chewing her foot. And that was apparently a real dream that Jennifer Lynch had. And then finally, she said, one of the things, because it's published by Simon & Schuster, one of the things Simon & Schuster told me was that I had received more fan mail from 13-year-old girls and male prison inmates than they had ever seen. Which I thought was interesting. And then she said, we all have sexual feelings, dark and light. And the sooner we recognize that and start to protect ourselves and each other over it, the better off we'll be. And I think that's a major theme. I think that's a major theme in Twin Peaks, is Laura Palmer's guilt and shame behind her sexual emotions and feelings. So that takes us to the book. And we're going to go through, and I'm going to pull out the stuff that I think is of interest and relevant to the larger theories of Twin Peaks. But by all means, this isn't covering everything, okay? So here we go. All right, so I don't know how to set this up besides just going right into it, okay? So we start out with July 22nd, 1984. Laura's 12 years old, and she kind of goes through the typical day of a 12-year-old. And we find out that she has a pony by the name of Troy. All right. And you already know where we're going with that, probably. Is it the white horse? Is it the white horse that we see throughout season 1 and 2? The horse of the apocalypse, if you will. And the entry ends with, P.S., I hope Bob doesn't come tonight. So we get this 12-year-old's day, and then it ends with the darkest possible sign-off, because we know that Bob was visiting her as young as 12 years old. We also hear about she has a cat named Jupiter. And of course, you know, that makes me think of the conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn, which was very pivotal in the opening of the Black Lodge. And it makes me wonder, did Leland name the cat Jupiter? I don't know. Lots of strange things that we can only guess what happened there. All right. The next day, July 23rd, 1984. I'm going to read you from the book. In the dream, I was walking through the woods out by the Pearl Lakes, and there was this very strong wind, not only around me. No, but only around me. It was hot. The wind, and about 20 feet away from me, there was this man with long hair and very large calloused hands. They were very rough, and he held them out to me as he sang. His beard didn't blow in the wind because the wind was only around me. The tips of his thumbs were black like coal, and he wiggled them around in circles as his hands got closer to me. I kept walking toward him, even though I didn't want to at all, because he frightened me so much. Now, we might think that this is Bob, but it's not. Because Pearl Lakes is where a lot of these mysteries happen in the canon of Twin Peaks. It's where the Log Lady was abducted when she was a child. It's where Leland claims he met Bob, and possibly Laura too, I don't know. But this isn't Bob, because he's got a beard, right? And Bob doesn't have a beard. But listen, she says he had black fingers from coal, or maybe he was a burned person, maybe he was an alien, who knows. But keep that in mind, because we see bearded woodsy guys in Fire Walk With Me and Season 3. Kind of interesting. I'll keep reading. Then I had to look down because there was this heat between my legs. Not nice warm, but hot. It burned me, and so I had to spread my legs open so they would cool. So that they would stop burning. So hot. And they started spreading by themselves like they were going to snap off my body. And I thought, I'm going to die this way. And how will anyone understand that I tried to keep my legs closed? But they burned, and I couldn't. And then the man looked at me and smiled this awful smile. And in Mom's voice, he sang, "You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me." And I tried to talk again, but I couldn't. And I tried to move, but I couldn't do that either. And he said, "Laura, you are home." And I woke up. Now, there's some weird stuff going on here, because as we go through the diary, we find out that Laura has this strange interest in sex, yet also a lot of shame and guilt behind it. And then, of course, we know Bob is sexually assaulting her. And then we also have there's these different themes of Laura's dream world becoming real and manifesting in reality. And we have this weird thing of her mother's voice with, saying Laura. I don't know how that all fits in, right? But we talked about that in the pilot and in season 2 with Waldo the bird. It's like, Laura, Laura. Like, that kind of keeps happening. And this time it could be the entity's voice. We're not sure, but it says it was Mom's voice that was singing, "You'll come a-waltzing Matilda to me." And then, "Laura, you're home." I think that means the mother, Sarah Palmer. The next day, Laura's mom later talks to her about the dream and says, no dreams at all, except Mom says she heard me calling out to her, and then I hooted like an owl. So Sarah heard Laura dreaming, and she was hooting like an owl. The owls are not what they seem. The first few diary entries, she's describing a lot of adolescent experiences, which seemed very genuine based upon my memories of being 12 years old. You know, she's playing around with her friends, Donna in this instance. She's curious about sexuality, yet she has this sort of childlike innocence about it and a little bit of shame baked into it. Like, she knows she's not supposed to think these things. And these are all kind of, I wouldn't say all my experiences, but, you know, I remember being 12 and being very interested in sex as well, and also having that sort of childlike innocence. Like, I'm sure my parents were mortified. Like, I probably was like a little baby to them still, you know? But, you know, I remember I was wearing sweatpants to school still. I was wearing Batman t-shirts to elementary school. Yet I was very sexually charged. It was in the summer between 5th and 6th grade that I, you know, started becoming sexually aware of things. So I don't think, you know, to read it as an adult, you're like, man, 12 is so young. But when I was that age, I was interested in these things too. I'm sure that wasn't everyone's experience, but it was mine, and apparently Laura's. So it's a weird juxtaposition to talk about. It's a little uncomfortable, to be honest, you know, because the last thing you want to talk about is a 12-year-old with sexual thoughts, right? I mean, and that's what's strange about the diary. She's talking about very juvenile things, eating candy and getting zits and smoking cigarettes, you know, sneaking cigarettes in, and then, of course, being curious about what sex is like. And there's various entries in the diary where it seems like she feels shame for being so interested in it. She equates it to being bad and thinks bad things will happen if she doesn't stop thinking about these. Yes, she's drawn to it. She's even masturbating in the book. I can't help but think there's some maybe religious or cultural shame and guilt put into it, though she doesn't really talk about religion. But she does say that Donna is a good person and she wishes she could be like Donna. And we know that Donna did go to church. Okay. July 30th, 1984, she talks about Ben Horn, and I proposed that Ben Horn was grooming her as a child. She talks about the tension between Ben Horn and Audrey Horn. She says, each time there's a party or a get-together at the Great Northern, Benjamin puts me on his lap or knee and sings to me softly in my ear. Sometimes I feel very bad for Audrey because when she sees him singing to me, it must make her sad because she often runs from the room and doesn't come back until her mother makes her. Now, because she's sitting on Ben's lap and he's singing softly in her ear, does that mean that's a pedophile thing? No, not necessarily. But given Ben's later falling in love with Laura, I don't know. Again, open to interpretation. Because Ben's kind of a creepy dude. But, you know, that doesn't mean that those things make you a pedo. So, I don't know. August 2nd, 1984. She talks about having an orgasm in her sleep. She has a dream about becoming pregnant. So, we're talking, you know, nocturnal emission stuff. We're talking about possibly an incubus like Bob coming and impregnating her. She's having a vision of this. A premonition, if you will. August 7th, 1984. I'll probably be a gift to Satan if I am not careful. Sometimes when I have to see Bob, I think I'm with Satan anyway. And I'll never make it out of the woods in time to be Laura, good and true and pure, ever again. So she's aware of this. She's aware that Bob is an evil force. She calls him Satan. And maybe he is. Maybe he is Satan incarnated. And of course, the woods, she knows the woods is a place where a lot of these things are destined to happen. August 11th. Laura sees an owl right above her in a tree, and she says, something about him is strange. I know it is a boy owl, and I feel like he's watching me. August 16th. The woods are calling her in. She says, I've been in the woods again, lost, but have been led. Something led her out of the woods. She's got these supernatural forces and owls and spirits talking to her. August 31st, she talks about getting her first period and how excited her mother was for this event. There's a bit of a doppelganger talk. She says, sometimes I think there is someone inside me, but it is another stranger part of me. Sometimes I see her in the mirror. September 15th, she talks about distrust because someone's been looking through her diary and she warns them to stay out of the diary. Then She goes a full year without a single diary entry. Now it's October 3rd, 1985, so she's, what, 13? And at this point, she had found out Ben Horn bought the pony, Troy, and she originally thought her father, Leland, bought her the horse, but now she found out Ben did. Was Ben Horn grooming Laura, or was he just a nice guy? She implies that Ben was had her sitting on his knee. I don't know. I mean, there was nothing else in the whole show that made me think that Ben was a pedo. Is he a groomer and was grooming her until she was 18? Or, well, I mean, 17, I think, when she was at One-Eyed Jack's, which was his operation, remember? And season two, he admits being in love with Laura and sleeping her with her, which is very creepy, and of course, she was underage. Also, on the same entry, October 3rd, Laura says, "Dinner was good tonight. One of my favorite meals. Potato pancakes with creamed corn topping and vegetables on the side." Ah, the creamed corn. Very relevant, because if you remember, Alice Tremont and her grandson had hands full of creamed corn when Donna showed up with the Meals on Wheels. We're going to go more into that in Firewalk with Me. The Garmin Bogia. We also find out that Jupiter got hit by a car, so there's a little bit of trauma, like they do in the Disney movies, right? These kids always have to witness these animals being killed. October 12th, 1985. She starts experimenting with pot at the bookhouse with these Canadian guys, Josh, Tim, and an unnamed guy. And they talk about the idea of other worlds. And I can't help but think, we have a little bit of drug usage combined with sexual contact being a gateway or a portal opening up. Bob wanting this portal to open up. October 20th, she goes back to the bookhouse again. There's some 22-year-old men there, and they're giving her and Donna some alcohol. They end up skinny dipping with these men, and Laura, she's making out with them, and she even notes that she's only 13 and these guys are 22. And she implies that someone else was in control of her body. She says, "And I said, mainly because I knew Donna was more freaked out than I was about all this, I said, let's make tonight a play night. We can all go home with that nice feeling of wishing more had happened. Donna and I are not going to go all the way with you." She's talking to the boys. "When it came out of my mouth, I couldn't believe it for a second. Who was talking? What was I, Laura Palmer, 13 years old, doing out here in the woods like this with three naked boys 9 years older than I am?" Now, they do end up fooling around and touching each other under the water, and Laura remarks about how blissful all of this was. And she also opens up to the idea of pain being a gateway to the shadow, right? In last chapter, remember, when she was talking about trying pot and drugs and a gateway, right? So she's opening up to her doppelganger through pain. November 10th, we get an origin story for the log lady of why she carries the log. This one's actually really interesting. Laura has a dream about 1400 River Road, so she heads out there with Troy, her pony, and she finds the log lady there. Laura recalls her face in the dream, and Log Lady says, "I know you're feeling curious about this place and about me." And then she tells her, Log Lady tells Laura that she had a dream that told her also to come to this location at 1400 River Road. She said, "I dream like other people sometimes. It just happens." And this is like the Cooper-Laura dream connection that these two have. So the Log Lady tells Laura she knew a lot of things about her, special things. She said Laura wouldn't worry like she does, and if she pays attention to the things around her, special things will come, and tells Laura that things are not what they seem. And we also hear Laura get to the log lady's location, and she says, I don't know what I would do if that happened, so I kept seeing this address in my head each time I finished a thought, no matter what it was. And finally, I found myself in front of this very old abandoned gas station. I got off Troy and tied him up at the frame that was still there. The frame that goes around the top of the pumps. The one with the signs telling you which gas is which. Grass was growing there, and I just let him graze so I could look around. When I walked around Troy so that I was completely facing the station, I saw the log lady standing very quiet with her log, right underneath the piece of wood that said 1400 River Road. She smiled at me, and I realized I had seen her face in my dream. We didn't say anything to each other for a long time. We just started smiling. I wasn't uncomfortable, but I was pretty curious about what I was there for. And just as I was watching this, she spoke to me. Now, we haven't gone into the convenience store at, in Twin Peaks, in the Fire Walk With Me and season 3, there's going to be more in regards to this abandoned gas station. I think. I propose. I can't really get into it too much, but I do think that this might be the same thing. I don't know. We'll cross that bridge when we get to it in season 3. I'm going to keep reading you from this same entry because it's really good. Here are some of the things she told me. She said that sometimes the woods are a place to learn about things and to learn about yourself. Oftentimes the woods are a place for other creatures to be, and it is not for us. She said that sometimes people go camping and learn things they shouldn't. Children are prey sometimes. I think that's how she said it. What else? I tried so hard to remember everything. Oh, she told me that she would be watching, and someday people would find out that she sees things and remembers them. She said that it's important to remember things you see and feel. Owls are sometimes big. There, that was the one I had forgotten totally. Owls are sometimes big. I hope that doesn't mean my mom talked about that owl dream I had. I don't think so, but that's the only way it makes any sense to me. So, there is this weird connection with the whole town and Laura, particularly her mother and the log lady, who both see, I don't know, prophetic things for her. Let's see. Let's keep reading here. I lost my spot now. Now what do I do? Either way, we kept sitting together, and I listened to her hum this song that I had never heard before. And I thought it was very nice. It made me feel safe, which I think she was trying to make me feel. I feel sorry for her that people think she is strange and weird. She isn't at all. I could see in her eyes that something had hurt her. But I didn't even begin to understand what it was until Mom told me when I got home. She said that Margaret, the log lady, had a husband who was a firefighter. He was killed fighting a fire. And Mom said it was awful because he tripped over a root or something and fell headfirst into hot coals and burnt himself to death face first. They had just been married a little while when he died, and since then, Margaret has been very quiet and has kept her pain to herself. Mom also said that she didn't have her log until after her husband died. I didn't know any of this when I was out there at 1400 River Road with her, but it didn't really matter, I guess. I told her I thought she was a very nice and special person and that I was glad I had paid attention to my dream because I wouldn't have wanted to miss talking to her. I told her I hoped she was right about my life having special things in it and that I would look for them because I want my life to be good. Then I told her something that I hope she never repeats. I didn't even expect to say it. And to tell you the truth, I didn't even know where it came from. I told her that sometimes things happen that no one knows about. They happen in the woods when it's very dark. I told her that sometimes I wasn't even sure these things were real, and sometimes I think they are more real than the sun coming up in the morning. And the thought of that frightened me very much. She looked away from me, I remember, when I finished. I thought I had said something that upset her. She grabbed her log tight, then looked back at me, said that I was a very beautiful girl and that many people would love me in my life. I hope many people do love me in my life. Someday someone will love me the way the boys did, but even more. I wonder where that person is right now, and if he is wondering where I am and what I look like and when we will finally meet. I wonder if Margaret has ever thought about sex the way that I do. So, the log lady definitely has a connection with Laura and is trying to guide her. She is a bit of the, what would you call it? In the hero's journey, there's the goddess that is the one that guides the hero on their journey into the other realm. And I think that's Log Lady's role here. Laura has another dream. Oh, no, November 20th, another dream. She says, I was in a room. It was very empty, and I was feeling badly that it was empty. I thought it was my fault that nothing was there. I was crouched in one of the corners of the room, and I was staring at this one spot on the other end of the room because I knew something was going to be there soon. After a minute, I started to get very cold, and I thought that I saw something, but it disappeared. Then I looked away because I was trying to find the door that went to another room and out of this one because I wanted to see if the furniture was in another room. I felt very bad about something, and I wanted to fix things so that I could stop feeling so guilty. I guess that's what I was feeling, guilt. I turned back to look across the room, and there was an enormous rat sitting there. I knew in the dream that it was coming after me, and that it wanted to bite my foot off. I became so afraid. I saw it closer and closer to me, and I tried to think of a way to stop it or a place to run away, but there wasn't anywhere to go or anything I could do. Now, this is interesting on a couple levels. First off, it sounds a lot like the Red Room, right? Because of the, it was empty, and then she wanted to go to the other room that might have the furniture, which is kind of like when Cooper goes through and see at the end of season two, through all those rooms in the Red Room. And of course, Laura was in there. Also, it's interesting because Jennifer Lynch said that that dream about the rat happened in real life. Now, I don't know if she was talking about just the rat part, or was it the whole room sequence? Which would be even more interesting because David Lynch said that he was inspired. He got a vision of the Red Room sequences. He touched the roof of a hot car and he got a vision of the Red Room. Could it be that David and Jennifer Lynch have a dream connection? That they both, I don't know, had visions of the Red Room. And then we jump to April 23rd, 1986. She's talking about being bored at school. She's like, what, 14 now? Her and Donna have been getting more distant. She's starting to have darker dreams, dreams about killing herself. And she talks to her mom about the woods. And her mother starts talking to her about sex. Mom came to my room right after to ask if I was all right. And I told her I was fine. I was just having nightmares about the woods. The look on her face went from sadness to hopefulness. Then, unfortunately, she began something I didn't need to hear at all. She started telling me about the birds and bees, and about birth control and babies, and all this ridiculous stuff about how my dreams were just part of my changing body, and maybe I just needed some questions answered. Why did Laura talking about the woods remind her mother of sex and womanhood? Remember when we did a season two, like a wrap-up show where we talked about the theories of Twin Peaks? We talked about the symbolism of the woods being the feminine energy. It's almost like the woods are guiding her into womanhood or sexuality or something. June 22nd, 1986. I don't remember when it started, but he has always had long hair. He knows everything about me and knows how to frighten me more than any of the dreams I have already told you about. He first started to play with me. We would chase each other through the woods and he would always find me, but I could never find him. He would come up behind me and grab my shoulders and ask me my name. I would tell him it was Laura Palmer. And then it talks about he would shame her and say that her private parts, he would like, I don't know how R-rated we want to get here. He would use his hands to touch her private parts, and then say how bad she smelled. And it's interesting that he asked her the name. Like, here is this weird supernatural entity that can apparently progress through space-time, and he doesn't know her name? Is it because he needs her to say it on a magical level? Because knowing someone's name is a... knowing their real name gives magical power that one can have over you. That's why magicians use the, you know, the alias names. And in this story, in the book, I mean, in the diary, he does all kinds of perverted things to this poor girl. He makes her hold his ejaculate in her hands and makes her lick it clean, which it'll kind of be a reference in Fire Walk With Me. You know, you'll recognize that when we get there. He makes her say this terrible poem. The little bitch is awfully sorry. The little bitch drinks you up. In this seed is death indeed. And Laura says, I hope that if there is a God, he will understand that I'm trying to keep clean. And if this is a test he's given me, I'll find a way to pass it. I bet it's a test. I bet God wants me to prove that I can take orders. Or maybe that I'm not afraid to die and come be with him. Maybe Bob knows God, and that is why he always knows what I am feeling inside. God must be telling him what to do to me. God wants me not to be afraid, maybe, of being dirty. If I'm not afraid, he'll take me to heaven. And as you know, I mean, we already know Laura Palmer's dead, and as you see in Fire Walk With Me, there is argument that... You know, and this is a larger theory of Twin Peaks. There's argument that Laura is sort of the one, the Neo. She's on the mission, and she has a higher purpose. That's why everyone is so concerned with Laura and connected with Laura. July 25th, 1986. She talked about trying to tease Bob as a way to show that she didn't have fear, because that's the whole idea, is that she's going to overcome this fear because that's what she thinks God wants her to do. She would do things like rub her panties on a tree and pinch her nipples. She would lay out in the woods and get high and masturbate and all kinds of stuff. She says, the wind began to come up and I felt it move over my bare chest. And I remember saying, oh, whoever that is, I like that. Yes, I like that very much. I'm going to skip past some of the stuff. I touched my secret button. I said, Bobby, Laura has a sweet muffin here for you, nice and clean. And again, not a plot spoiler, but in Fire Walk With Me, we hear her, there's a scene, I think it's in the missing pieces, the deleted scenes, where she says, I am the muffin. And I got to think this is where that came from. On the way out of the woods, an owl almost kills her, and she says, I could feel the power in his wings as he shot by me. I thought of the log lady, something she had said. Many things are not what they seem. August 3rd, 1986, she talks about having this masculine side that's taken over, and, you know, the male-female polarities, and the Baphomet is an interesting concept here. Maybe there's a reconciliation of opposing forces to think about here. August 4th, 1986, she talks about having two Lauras and how one is naughtier. And this one starts dating Bobby Briggs. She talks about having sex with him and then laughing at him in order to protect herself, even though it hurt her to do so. Which, if you listen to, or if you watch Twin Peaks, I think it's season one, might be episode six, the last episode. I think it's that when Dr. Jacoby has Bobby in his office and he flat out, like he knew that this exact scene happened, because he asks Bobby if she ever laughed at him after they had sex. October 1, Bobby talks about taking Laura over. Well, she talks about how Bobby tells her that he wants her to meet his friend Leo Johnson, of course. She writes that Bob means beware of Bob. She starts doing cocaine and partying. She talks about getting a woman off. Fast forward to June 24th, 1987. And she, you know, she's spiraling. She lets her pony go. She lets Troy go. And she says she just smacked him on the butt and sent him out so he could be free, because she felt guilty that she wasn't able to take care of him. And she felt like the horse was in danger from Bob. And she thinks everyone around her is at risk, and she feels bad for everyone. And it makes me think, if the white horse that we see throughout the show is an artifact of trauma, it's Laura's trauma, something she loved and she felt protective over, but disappointed she couldn't protect. Because I, you know what's weird is I have nightmares myself about, you know, I grew up in the 80s. And back in the 80s, not everyone would put dogs in the house, right? And it was just old school. We had a dog that we kept outside. There was this big ass cage that we had in a doghouse. And this poor dog was out there, and I would let him out a few times a day. And I feel this immense guilt over that. But I mean, I was just a kid. I was just, you know, it's not like I had any other context of what was right or wrong in that. And to be fair, like in the 80s, that's what some people did. They just, I don't know, treated animals like animals. And, you know, I've got, me and Josie got dogs, and I couldn't imagine. I couldn't imagine leaving a dog outside all the time. I mean, if it got super cold, we would put him in the garage, but I just think, man, like, what an awful way to live. And I have nightmares about my dog growing up, still to this day. Every now and then I'll have a nightmare that I forgot to let him out, or I forgot to feed him, or whatever. Anyway, so I feel like I understand this trauma in a way. November 12th, 1987. She's hanging out with Bobby and Leo. They're doing drugs. They go to this place called Lowtown. She almost gets killed. Bobby ends up shooting and, I'm guessing, killing a guy. She drives home and she accidentally kills a cat. And this triggers memories of Jupiter, because her cat got hit. And the cat's owner, this cat that she killed, is a little girl named Danielle. And she comes over and talks to Laura about it. And Laura feels like she's come kind of full circle with, now she's the awful person that killed this other cat. I mean, her guilt is just stacking up. November 13th, Leo takes Laura out into the woods. And what is she? She's 14 or 15 at this point, right? And he takes her out to the woods to go through this ceremonial orgy. Crazy. Bobby doesn't participate. He leaves. This is what she says. When we left the house, he put a blindfold around my head. He whispered, "Can you feel the darkness?" I told him I could. He said, "Good, I'm going to take you into it. Just like you wanted. I'll guide you, so you just walk with me until I tell you to stop. Can you keep a secret, little girl?" I wasn't sure if I should answer. "It's okay. Go ahead and tell me. Yes, I can keep a secret." I suddenly began to feel and smell the same deep musk of the woods. I know it well. I began to feel my fear setting in, and I had to roll my head up, loosen up, fight it. Remember what this is about. The secret is that sometimes right in this spot, I hear voices. So Leo's telling her a secret that Leo hears voices as well. He gets possessed sometimes. And I postulate that maybe, because in season 1 and 2, he's a terrible person. And at the end of season 2, he kind of has a change of heart. Remember? He let Major Briggs go because he wanted her to save Shelley, which is crazy because he was so abusive towards Shelley. And I feel like maybe his possession left him. He was possessed by spirits, and then, I don't know. I'm going to keep reading. "Whose voices do you hear? The voices I don't know, but sometimes if I'm very quiet, I feel that I can feel these people around me. I can hear them talking about me, but if you were to try and see them, they would definitely disappear. Do you hear any voices now? I think I hear them faintly, coming in this direction. Does that scare you? I don't think so, no." So, Leo hears the voices coming. Laura's blindfolded. She's not scared. But here comes these spirits. These voices. She says, "I was ready for a busload of truckers to arrive and begin some kind of strange ceremony. I suddenly felt very exposed. I wondered how many people were on their way. I'm going to help you sit down over here." Leo sat me down, and I realized I was in a quite comfortable chair, dead in the middle of the woods. What was this place? Had I ever seen it during the day? Music began to play, strange sounds of water and something I couldn't place. And a drum, low. I felt it in my chest. It was loud enough that I was suddenly unable to sense by sound if someone was near me or not. I heard in my ear, "Wait here, relax, enjoy." I'm not sure I can even describe to you the next 5 hours of time. The music was constant, a rhythm that made me sway and ache for more of everything, more of the hands that were suddenly upon me. Lips soft along my neck, hands on my chest, thighs, and face. Voices in my ears whispering close, backing away. I think that there were 3 different women and at least 4 men, Leo included. I was tied eventually to the chair with a rope that bound my hands almost to the point of discomfort, which I knew was part of the game and well planned. Each and every fantasy one might conjure late at night, with the exception of farm animals, was performed on, with, or for me. It was like I'd been swallowed by a dream, perfect in every way. My only responsibility was to maintain my blindness and allow each person his chance to come and be with me. I could hear them, the others who would wait in line to see me, just voices in the woods whose bodies became images I could hear, see them through the sounds they make. Everything had become so sensitive. I could hear them all night as they would excite each other to the point of small internal convulsions, billions of tiny waves of light, water, electricity running through them. All of them would react with a strange joy and amazement, a thirst when one would reach a climax. Even I, who sat away from them as if on display, more a trophy than a freak, felt pleasure in the sounds around my feet. These people, all of various ages, spent evenings in the woods, forgetting names and histories, using only their most basic feelings and wishes to be held and touched, wanted, and completely accepted no matter what they looked like, or who they were at work or school the following mornings. It was dark and strange and almost intoxicating at times. What was going on in the woods? What is this ceremony? Were they spirits or were they real people? You know, she talks about them not being at work or school, and it makes me think of the Hellfire Cave rituals where all the elites would put on masks and do satanic orgies in the caves and stuff like that. Or it's possibly Black Lodge demon spirits. The next thing she remembers is Leo taking her home. She said, "I had a daydream as I made my way upstairs that Mom woke up and asked how the orgy had been. I gave her all the details, and she began reliving her own experiences of strange evenings in the woods. She wanted to call her friends and tell them her daughter had been in an orgy. Wasn't that wonderful? The daydream ended when I reached the top of the stairs and saw that my bedroom door was wide open. I stopped dead in my tracks. I looked towards my parents' bedroom. The door was closed tight. When I turned back to my room, what I saw was horrifying. I could clearly see a man's shoe behind my door, and he emerged smiling. It was Bob." Sarah Palmer, Laura's mom, may have been involved in these same demonic orgies in the woods. And keep that in mind as we get into season 3. I think these dreams Laura has are shared dreams, some of which are real, and they can't really distinguish between reality and dreams. Her and her mother share these things, right? Okay, December 16th, 1987. She meets Jacques and Waldo, the bird. She finds out why they use a football. There's a little, you know, a little origin story of the football they use for drugs in season 1. Because Bobby's a football star and Jacques also used to be a football star. She's doing more orgies. She does some tied up in a chair at Jacques' cabin. But we have this duality here with Bobby Briggs, who's Johnny Football Star, but he's also selling drugs through the football. Just like the beginning of the pilot, right? You had the two ducks, the two dogs. December 21st. She starts messing around with the Flesh World to make some extra money, as you know in season 1. Plays a role. February 1st, 1988. She's what, 16 now-ish? She lists the initials of everyone she's had sex with. I'm curious if anyone's ever decoded this. There's maybe 30, 40 names in there. The first four are B, which I think is Bob. Maybe he was the first one. She talks about him when she was 12. BB, which I'm thinking is Bobby Briggs. LJ, which is Leo Johnson. RP, which I'm thinking is Ronette Pulaski. And then a whole bunch of other ones. She's starting to have less and less in common with Donna, which is pretty sad. April 7th, she gets a job at the perfume counter at Horns, which you know takes her over to One-Eyed Jack's eventually. April 21st, 1988, she gets some photos done for Flesh World, and she talks about having the red curtain backdrop. Now, all this is making me think that the Red Room, I mean, almost everything that happens in Twin Peaks, the Red Room is just artifacts of Laura Palmer's dream, and they manifest in reality. She said that the reason why is because the red window curtains were a large enough backdrop and the color was just sleazy enough so that if I posed the right way, I'd sell some copies. A million copies, excuse me. July 22nd, 1988. She says it's her sweet 16 birthday. Okay, she's 16 now. And she also says she is 7.5 weeks pregnant, which the math on that takes you back to the end of May. I didn't see anything of interest for the end of May as an entry about an orgy or nothing. You know what? Let's go back to the orgy entry in the woods. That was November of 87. That's definitely long before that. But she doesn't know who the baby is, and she's going to go to the clinic for the abortion. August 2nd, 1988, she has a conversation with Bob. There's lots of pages ripped out. Minimal context, right? Bob says stuff like, "Happy last days, Laura's baby." This is pretty dark, right? And Bob says that this is where it gets kind of wild. Bob says that she's an experiment and he doesn't actually want to kill her. He wants what happens before death. This, of course, is fear in the form of sustenance, garbambosia, cream corn, whatever. And he talks about falling into darkness, which is something we'll hear about in Fire Walk With Me. And Bob talks about how what she needs to do in order to walk through the fire walk with me. Is this enlightenment? Is it wisdom? Is it crossing the abyss? I don't know. I still don't know what fire walk with me means exactly. I'm interested if this baby is Bob's, if this is some Rosemary's Baby, Moonchild, Babylon working ritual. It's really hard to tell. I mean, they give you just enough to think. But I hope by the end of season 3 we'll have enough to put some ideas together. August 6th, 1988. She says she feels like she's living her life in order to die. There's this duality of life and death with Laura Palmer. August 10th, 1988. She goes to the clinic for the abortion and she says the doctor came in, his large hands already wrapped in rubber gloves. And his eyes as sterile as the room and utensils used there. He shook my hand. The rubber glove reminded me of something. Was it Bob? The last few moments with the baby were the hardest I've ever been through. What kind of decision was I making? Whose baby was it? Now, I'm not going to say a lot, but the rubber gloves being Bob, I thought that was really interesting. And that's all I'm going to say about that for now. August 20th, 1988. Mr. Battis at Horn's perfume counter there offers her a better job over at One-Eyed Jack's. And this whole time, Laura's trying to get clean from drugs and start helping elderly people. She starts the Meals on Wheels with Norma at the Double R. August 23rd, 88. Harold Smith comes into the diary. Harold thought death was outside his door. I guess he told Laura that. Did he let death... And is that why he was afraid to go outside? Death was at his door. And when in season 1 or 2, when he dies, did he let death in? I don't know. August 31st. We're getting close to the end, folks. August 31st, 1988. Just reread yesterday's entry, and I suddenly feel very embarrassed about being alive. The girl who received this diary on her 12th birthday has been dead for years. And I, who took her place, have done nothing but make a mockery of the dreams she once had. I'm 16 years old. I'm a cocaine addict, a prostitute who F's her father's employers. Oh, that must mean... Oh, I didn't catch that. That means Ben Horn is... Because Ben Horn is her father's employer. Not to mention half the effing town, and the only difference from last week is that now I'm getting paid for it. My life is whatever the other person in the room wants it to be. Therefore, when I am alone, my life is nothing. She's still dreaming about crazy stuff, including the giant owl. She says, I fell to my knees. Everything was silent. I looked up and there, 30 feet in front of me, was a gigantic owl. As I look back now, I am still unsure. Was he a friend or an enemy? We stood staring at each other for a long time. It felt as if he wanted to say something, but he didn't. I awoke hoping that what the log lady said... Owls are sometimes big, referred to tonight and meant that something good was going to happen to me. Now that I'm working at One-Eyed Jack's, I could use a good omen. I will pay attention to everything the way the log lady told me I should. I suspect that this would be the first of many things I will need to pay close attention to. P.S. I think that in order to ensure my privacy, I will need to start a second diary, one that, if found, will give the intruder the Laura that everyone thinks lives inside of me. I will have to spend time filling its pages. I wonder if life is still something I can make up. So this duality of Laura, now she's going to make a second diary as well, which is interesting because in Twin Peaks, there's two ledgers for the Packard Sawmill too. You know, when you look back on all this, it's very confusing. You think, how much of this is like the dream world? Is it all Laura's dream, the whole show? It's very strange. She talks about helping Josie with English. Josie also tries to get with Laura, by the way. She talks about helping Johnny and meeting Harold. She threatens to tell the world about Ben Horn. She talks about dating James in order to try and get sober. She has a dream about swimming, which is odd because she, as you know, she ends up dead in Black Lake up on the shore there. After Leland Bob puts her and wraps her in plastic and puts her in Black Lake. She starts seeing Dr. Jacoby and she says, "One on the way out of Harold's, Mrs. Tremont's grandson Pierre saw me and came up to me and pulled a gold coin out of my ear and walked away." Now, this is the second to last entry. And as you know, Pierre, Mrs. Tremont's grandson, is the David Lynch's son in real life, had the cream corn in his hands. There's something very mystical about the Tremonts. They play a very crucial role in Twin Peaks. What is it exactly? I don't know. I don't know yet. But it is a role. And then her last entry before death, and there's a bunch of pages ripped out right before the last entry. Her last entry says, "I know who he is. I know exactly who and what Bob is, and I have to tell everyone. I have to tell someone and make them believe. Someone has torn pages out of my diary, pages that helped me realize maybe, pages with my poems, pages of writings, private pages. I'm so afraid of death. I'm so afraid that no one will believe me until after I've taken the seat that I fear has been saved for me in the darkness." Man, that's insane, right? She's afraid of the seat of death saved for her in the darkness. So she knows she has to die. "Please don't hate me. I never meant to see the small hills and the fire. I never meant to see him or let him in. Please, diary, help me explain to everyone that I did not want what I've become. I did not want to have certain memories and realizations of him. I only did what any of us can do in any situation, my very best. Love, Laura. P.S. I'm giving you to Harold for safekeeping. I hope I see you again. I can't stay sober anymore. I just can't. I have to be numb." And that's where it ends. And I mean, it could be the most powerful fictional book I've ever read. You know, not to be hyperbolic, but it's a dark ride, you know, and it really, like, the book is what really makes you feel for Laura. And then when you watch Fire Walk With Me, it just drives it home, you know. It's an incredible story. So anyway, that's the secret diary of Laura Palmer. Thanks for diving deep, folks, into the world of Twin Peaks and the Grey Lodge. I hope you're enjoying it. Your next assignment here is you're gonna watch Fire Walk With Me, and I'm gonna come back and we're gonna do a Fire Walk With Me film analysis, and it's gonna be a super mega duper banger. It's gonna be long. It's gonna be longer than the movie. I'm telling you right now. Be ready for that. So it's going to be a banger. And then after that, you're going to wait 25 years. I'm going to make you wait 25 years and we're going to do season 3. No, I'm just kidding. You know I'm kidding about that. I'm not even going to make you wait 25 days if I do this right. But after Fire Walk With Me, we're going to do The Secret History of Twin Peaks, the book from 2017. Then we do season 3. And then we're going to wrap it up. And you're going to then say, "Holy crap, I got to watch all this stuff again." So, there you go. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting the show. I appreciate you. Till next time, stay positive.